I'm Lise Davis. Welcome to It's Your Health on Thinking Out Loud on WUML 91.5 FM with Nancy Dreyfuss, a psychospiritual psychotherapist and relationship coach. Today, Nancy will be talking about how her own family dynamics and wounding around relationship fueled her journey around becoming real and connecting to others in a realer way. She believes that the place where we can feel the most limited is often the doorway to tapping into something much bigger. She is the author of Talk to Me Like I'm Someone You Love, Relationship Repair in a Flash. Nancy, welcome to It's Your Health on Thinking Out Loud on 91.5 FM.
Hi, Lisa. I am so happy to be here.
Oh, I adore you, Nancy. And I'm so happy. And you were on recently talking about your fantastic book, Talk to Me Like I'm Someone You Love, Relationship Repair in a Flash. And today, you know, Nancy, I talked about in the introduction that we'll be talking about family dynamics and wounding around relationships that fueled your journey to the beautiful and amazing woman that you are. I added that part.
Well, let me begin by saying a word about my book.
Oh, sure.
How I got there. My book is a series of what I call flashcards for couples to hold up in the midst of fighting, like, I'm afraid if I say I'm sorry, you'll make everything all my fault. When you talk to me that way, I just feel small. I hate walking on eggshells around you. I don't feel heard. And people see this book, and they say, my God, why didn't anyone dream this up before? How did you dream it up? And they talk to me about it as if it was like some sort of creative idea that just came out of a hat. And the truth of the matter is, it is the expression of, you know, over 20 years of personal growth work and my own story. And I thought since I was going to be on the show a couple of times, that I might say a little bit about my background and how a book, really a guidebook to authenticity, came about, because I was so inauthentic. I grew up in a home with a mother who was well-meaning but really into glamour. And when I was 11 years old, I was given a pair of false eyelashes with a note that said, darling, never take these off. And the truth of the matter is, I was so convinced, even in third grade, that there was something unattractive about me. I wouldn't play old maid with the other girls. I was terrified I'd end up with the old maid card. And so I grew up, I couldn't go to college till I first spent a year at modeling school. And I was pretty much, by the time I was 20 or 21, kind of a zombie. You know, I was into makeup and trying to look good. And I had made a decision that I was going to be a journalist. And I actually, in fifth grade, had the conscious thought, if I work for the New York Times, nobody will notice I don't have a man on my arm. This was a very conscious thought.
In fifth grade?
Fifth grade.
That's like 10 or 11. That's incredible.
Working on the school newspaper, I knew, and I was already planning my face-saving life strategy.
Oh, my goodness.
I'm a graduate of the Columbia School of Journalism. I became a crusading reporter, writing on people who were marginalized or who I perceived as victims, like I felt like a victim. And in fact, I wrote a story for which I got a job offer at the New York Times about a woman who had cerebral palsy and had athetosis. She looked funny. She had kind of a retarded look, but was actually a poet and a therapist. And it was my story, what it's like to be a sensitive person who looks funny on the outside. And I got a job offer at the New York Times, and I was going to move to New York. And 6 weeks before I was supposed to move to New York, I was sent on an assignment to kind of expose a meditation group as a cult. Except I had my first meditative experiences, kind of experiences of inner peace. And 2 days after I began meditating, I had in one day this experience that I had locked my keys in the car, and I couldn't move, and it was my fault, and I didn't feel terrible about it. And more astoundingly, an editor told me that I had written a story that was mediocre. And more astoundingly, it didn't really bother me.
Wow.
And suddenly I had an awareness, life changed. That life, that there was some place inside of oneself where you could just be centered and feel okay, independent of what was going on outside of you. So different from what I had learned as a child. You know, when I was a kid, I was chubby, and my mother would steal the size 14 belt when I needed the size 12 dress. And I would say to her, but Mommy, you're stealing. And she would say, no, I'm not. You need that belt. So there was a lot about reality, Lisa, that was really very confusing to me. All this emphasis on glamour and all of this distortion of reality. I was either going to sink or swim. Something happened. I felt so unreal and so disconnected. Something arose in me that I had to learn how to start telling the truth. And what I really want to say to people is that when you start telling the truth, it's not always comfortable, it's often awkward, and often what telling the truth is saying, I feel disconnected, I feel invisible, I don't know what to say right now. But I knew that if I didn't start just saying the truth, no matter how unattractive or uncomfortable it was, I would have no life.
Wow, that is so inspiring. And how did your mother handle this when you started being more authentic?
After I decided, with having these meditative experiences, mm-hmm. that I was going to become a meditation teacher. And I had a pretty extreme, you know, glamour-oriented Jewish mother. And probably the hardest thing I've ever done in my life was telling her, I'm not going to the New York Times, I'm going to the ashram.
Oh my gosh.
It was kind of difficult.
Oh, I'm sure.
But eventually I decided I was going to leave journalism because I had an awareness that I could get millions of readers upset over the world's grievances. But I was only adding more pain and upset to the world. And I decided eventually that I wanted to become a therapist. And I'm going to tell you an interesting story that happened. I was applying to graduate school, and I got into the final round of graduates, and the last admissions procedure was 10 candidates sitting at a round table with a microphone for 4 hours being observed through one-way mirrors by 3 therapists. And I happened to have been in a group where everyone but me was a radical or a protester involved with helping the poor, helping a minority group. There were grape pickers and somebody who was head of the Gay Boston Collective and all sorts of protesters and people doing good causes. Well, I was a middle-class Jewish doctor's daughter from northern New Jersey. I had never taken place in a protest. And in fact, what I wanted to do was have psychotherapy clients who paid me. Even though you can hear that I can talk and I can express myself.
Oh, yeah.
3 hours I sat and did not open my mouth because I couldn't, I had nothing to share about what was going on in terms of saving the poor and saving the world. And finally, more out of desperation than any strategy, I simply sat there and said, I have no idea what to say right now. I am a upwardly mobile middle-class girl from northern New Jersey. I have never taken part in a protest. I haven't thought of being a psychotherapist in order to help the poor. In fact, I hope to make money doing while I'm helping people. And this is just how it is for me. And, you know, of course, I got into the graduate program. And what I really feel like I'm here for is to be a voice for people, really just to tell the truth.
When you're talking about your mother pressuring you, you know, my mother would always say to me, you're so beautiful, except your nose is too big for your face. You have such big, beautiful eyes, but you have a little chin, and you have a small jaw, and you have this little face, and if only, you know, you had a smaller nose, you'd be so, so beautiful. And I was 14. I had frizzy hair and braces, and I was looked like, people called me olive oil, and I didn't have any confidence, and so I didn't want to do it, but then I also felt, you know, pressure. She pressured me to do it, but then part of me wanted to do it, and then it ended up, I did do it, and he didn't do a very good job, which part of me is relieved, because if you look at me, you would never think I had a nose job, because it's still big, and it's crooked, and I've always wanted to get it fixed and have it on my terms, but I also don't want to end up looking like someone who you can tell has, you know, who had it, but Yeah, it was terrible. What I really needed my mother to say was something that a woman said to me at a bat mitzvah just a few days before the procedure. She said, and she had obviously had her nose down, and she said, "I think you're beautiful the way you are. I don't think you should do it." And that's what I needed to hear from my mother. And my father would say, you know, "Diane, leave her alone. Leave her alone. She's fine." And my mother would say, "But I'm just trying to help. She could be, you know, she's pretty, but she could be stunning."
Well, Lisa, you know what would have helped? Because there's the whole issue here of taking ownership. Your mother could have done what she did if she had said to you, "I know I'm being neurotic." If she said to you, "I'm sure this has as much to do with my own sense of self-worth than it has to do with you." If there had been some ownership of where she had been coming from, it would have been easier for you to hear, as well as her really giving you a clear message, "Sweetie, this is really your choice. I know that I'm probably crossing a boundary." There was no personal responsibility coming from her, which is what makes all of this very oppressive, Lisa. This with you, Lisa, that you won't understand immediately, but you'll understand when I finish. It's called 99% a bitch, 100% an angel.
No, you're right. I don't.
No one gets it. But what's relevant to this conversation, when you only tell 99% of your truth and you're still feeling anxious about whether you're going to be received, often you'll come out speaking stridently or critically, or there'll be an edge in your voice. But when you tell somebody the thing that you thought you could never say, when you go that 100%, and you're sort of feeling like the air quality has changed, and you just said something to somebody you never thought you could say, and it's so coming from a sincere place in you, people actually hear it better than when you only tell a partial truth.
Oh, I like that. Where did you hear that, or did you make that up?
No, I don't remember where I heard it. I didn't make it up, but it would be like saying to your partner, "You know, I'm just really not in the mood for sex tonight," 10 times, as opposed to just saying, "This is the truth. I haven't been attracted to you for the last 6 weeks, and this is why."
Ooh, okay.
And it may seem a little harsh.
Yeah.
you will get somebody's attention.
That's true.
When outed, you will get to a place where you really might want to make love again. You know, I have a 2-minute tape of a couple having a real life argument that they've had many times and many men and women have had, where he says to her, I'd like us to have sex. And she says, "This is how you approach me. We haven't been close in a month. I need to feel like we're relating to each other." And he says, "Well, why can't we ever do it my way? We always have to do it your way." And, you know, she's arguing for wanting to feel close and connected, and he's wanting a sexual experience. And at a certain moment, he holds the flashcard that says, "I don't feel heard." Sympathy goes towards him. And, in fact, she begins melting, because what she's asking for is that he relates to her. The moment he goes from arguing for what he wants to just saying, "I don't feel heard," she's actually getting what she wants, a man who's relating to her.
Wow.
Can you kind of see how that would work?
Oh, completely. That's why I love your book.
Oh, thank you.
And I want to encourage people to go on my site, it's yourhealthradio.org, go to audio archives, and listen to Nancy's amazing interview talking about Talk to Me Like I'm Someone You Love, Relationship Repair in a Flash, because it's such a wonderful book. And my husband loved it, too. It's so helpful. You must get that a lot. It's so good.
Well, people do say, "How did you dream it up?" People say, "Why didn't anybody think of this before?" And it's really amazing to me that it works. You know, that the trick with the book, of course, like anything else, is to use it. And so it's the very act of going to get the book, hold up a flashcard, and actually see that when you give a message to your partner that's from the heart with no voice tone, unless you're dealing with a psychopath, you know, it's going to create connection. And so that's really my message for today. Don't worry about how to connect with another person. All you have to do is be connected to yourself in that person's force field. That's the secret that nobody ever taught us.
Oh, well, Nancy, I want to thank you so much. This has been so great, and I'm so happy that you're going to be coming on every month, and I believe it's going to be the third Thursday of the month. And it's terrific. I'm so glad that you came into my life. You're just an amazing person, and you have so much to offer, and my listeners are going to fall in love with you.
My website, Lisa Davis, you are a love. You are loved. Thank you. The site is nancydreyfus.com, www.nancydreyfus.com.
And your book is available everywhere?
And my book is available everywhere, and I would recommend that people just order it on Amazon.
Okay, great. And if people want to reach me, they can go to itsyourhealthradio.org.